From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shira Springer. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's been 3 years since Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In.
Everywhere I go, women say they're getting better relationships with their spouses, asking for more help at home, asking for the promotions they should be getting at work.
But have we overlooked who needs to lean out? Also today.
When I cook, I feel my ancestors around me. And that's what drives me. Someone's got to take this food and continue it.
Are we seeing a resurgence of the Jewish deli? Plus,
so you want to be a master of Pokemon!
The latest tech craze, Pokemon Go.
It is kind of weird going around and seeing everyone with their noses in their phones, but it is a very addictive game, and I am somewhat addicted to it already. We
all
live
in a Pokemon world. All that coming up on Radio Boston, but first, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. We want to begin today with the debates over what it would take to achieve gender equity in the workplace. The Massachusetts House is debating one part of it this hour, an equal pay bill. The bill would require employees to pay men and women equally for comparable work. It clarifies that employers can pay different salaries based on seniority, merit, and other factors related to the job. Full-time working women earn about 78% of what their male counterparts earn, according to the White House. The Senate has already passed its version of the bill, and there's no word yet on whether or not Governor Baker would sign a negotiated version. So that's one part of equity. Behind it is a larger idea, maybe most famously expressed by Facebook Sheryl Sandberg in her 2013 book, Lean In. Her book argues women must lean in professionally to go headfirst after their career goals. But 3 years on, after focusing on how to lean in, have we overlooked the other side of the coin? In this case, the other partner who needs to lean out. That's the idea posed by Carol Hay, an associate professor of philosophy and director of gender studies at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. She joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you.
Also joining us is Dr. Ray Levy. He's a clinical psychologist and the director of the Fatherhood Project at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Welcome, Ray.
Nice to see you. Thank you.
Carol, let's start with you. Tell us, what exactly is leaning out?
Well, I don't think leaning out is any one particular thing. I think leaning out is probably being committed to having certain kinds of conversations with your partner, right? So if you're in a relationship and you're committed to equality in the context of that relationship with your husband and wife, then that's going to require balancing a lot of the responsibilities, a lot of the sort of mundanities of life, right, as well as one's own career goals, right? And leaning out is sort of being committed to making sure that no one partner disproportionately bears the brunt of the mundane domestic stuff, right? The caregiving. This stuff's really important, but at the same time, it's not sexy. It doesn't have a lot of rewards at the end of the day for picking up the groceries, making sure the kids get to their dentist appointments, these sorts of things. So leaning out is really a commitment to making sure that one partner's career doesn't take precedence over the other's if, again, you are in this relationship where you're committed to equality. And again, one of the things that feminists have been talking about for an awful long time is that if we're not careful, if we just follow the social scripts that that we have in our society, women are going to end up taking on the brunt of this domestic work, right? So ever since Ariel Levy came up with the term the second shift, right, we've got this idea that women are responsible not just for their own career responsibilities, but also all of the domestic stuff.
Now, Ray, what do you make of the concept of leaning out? Is that how you would look at the situation?
Well, Carol described it in a different way than I read in the opinion piece that she wrote. But it's always been the case, I think, that educated parents would ask the question, one of us needs to be responsible for career and for the economic welfare of the family. And one of us needs to have more responsibility for the children. Now, that doesn't have to be the case now. The idea of leaning out or this discussion that Carol's talking about, I'm very supportive of. In fact, I think that's exactly what couples have to do. They have to figure out what works for them. Who is more ambitious? Can they both be ambitious? Where did the sacrifices have to be? Who's more inclined to need to succeed or to have a wonderful professional message to the world and needs to be free? And I'm all for the idea of equality. I think it's a very difficult concept to generalize about. I think it can be different in different couples. And I see that all the time in my work with fathers. I think these days fathers should be celebrated for their involvement in their families. We see it that fathers want to be more active, certainly than my father was and his generation, in family life. And our work at the Fatherhood Project is to help the fathers be involved, understand how important they are, and have the skills to be effective parents.
I want to get to points that you both brought up, but before we do, I want listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you think we need to be talking more about men leaning out? Are you someone who has leaned out? Has your partner leaned out? How do you feel about it? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Now, Ray, you say, you ask, can both members of a relationship be ambitious? And I want to pose that to both of you. Does somebody actually have to lean out? Is it possible in this day and age to have two people in a couple lean in? Start with you, Carol, and then we'll go with you, Ray.
I think you absolutely can, but I think a couple that has both partners pursuing career goals is going to have to be a couple of things. They're going to have to be lucky. They're going to have to be very well paid, and they're still going to have to find themselves making career sacrifices, right? Because I can actually tell you from personal experience, my husband and I, we met because we were hired for the same job. We were both university professors, and that's how we met. Fell in love. Goes from there. He's actually publishing a book about it this fall. If anyone wants to read it, it's called American Philosophy: A Love Story.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So I can say from personal experience, we are both very professionally motivated, and we have a child. We have a daughter. She's turning 4, and if he and I just kind of go along with what we want to do, we find ourselves sort of systematically giving him the space to pursue his career goals and me having not quite as much room. And this is, again, both of us committed to feminism. We wrote this op-ed together, right? We work together. And so if we just, if we think that, oh, yes, if a couple thinks that they can both just be committed to equality and be committed to their careers and that's it, and don't have these further conversations about leaning in and leaning out at different times, then chances are very good that the man's career is going to take precedence over the woman's. Because again, this is the culture we live in. These are the background social scripts that are informing our decision making, often unconsciously, right? And it starts from a very early age, right? Little girls are given dolls and toy kitchens and told, you know, that they should expect to be mamas, and boys are sort of told that they're going to be astronauts or farmers or whatever it is, and they're not told to expect to have to balance the demands of career with the demands of children. And Ray, I think this is actually why your work is really important, because you're giving a lot of fathers the room to and the skills needed to be able to negotiate this stuff. And I think you're right that even a few generations ago, we weren't doing this.
Ray, what do you say about both having two ambitious members of a couple?
Again, my emphasis is on each couple working out the demands of their life together and possibly their family life. I agree with Carol that there are these scripts that femininity, masculinity are to a large degree socially constructed. But part of maturity, part of growing up, is recognizing that you have choices to make, recognizing who you are and what you aspire to in life. But if there are, you know, dual career couples, there are several ways to work that out.
I want to stop you there, and I want to take a call from Lisa, who is calling from Groton, and she has an unusual situation that she wants to tell us about in her dynamic and her marriage. Lisa, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hi, thank you. Yes, so the point I wanted to bring up is that my husband makes probably 3 to 4 times as much income as I do, but we both acknowledge that I am the much more ambitious of the two of us. I am an attorney, public defender. I'm also a licensed certified social worker, and I have a lot of ambition in terms of making a difference in public service. And my husband has just been phenomenal in recognizing that even though he makes more money, he does not hold that over my head in terms of equality in our home. And I would actually say that my husband is more the primary parent than I am. And we originally planned to have 2 children, and because of my just the way that I have felt about parenting, we've decided to have 1 child instead. Our daughter's almost 4. So I just think it's always important to not always think about money as the only quality that allows somebody to be, or the aspiration for money to be the sole sort of ambition.
Lisa, I want to put this to Carol. She's in here nodding her head as you say money doesn't need to be the sole ambition or sole goal as you figure things out in a marriage. What do you say to Lisa?
Lisa, I think that's absolutely right. We should probably preface it by saying for a lot of couples, money does have to be the consideration, because the ability to lean out, to make the choice to lean out, is a privilege in a sense, right? Many couples are just trying to, you know, get food on the table. And so the discussion that we're having here really does apply really to a sort of very privileged subset of the population. But that said, I think if you find yourself in a situation or in a relationship where you have the kind of freedom to decide whether or not money is the only thing that's, or rather the most important thing in your lives, then yeah, absolutely. Considerations of justice really do have to come into play.
Before we go on here, I'd like to remind everybody that we want to hear from you. Listeners, you can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. We're going to turn now to Peter, who's calling from Belmont. Peter, what do you have to say about this issue of leaning in and leaning out?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to support and underscore the last point that was made, that this idea that we have a choice about whether to lean in or lean out is really quite a privileged one. And I don't think that's the case for most families today. I think most families are simultaneously leaning in and leaning out, and that the real negotiation, especially from a feminist perspective, is how do we ask men to do both, because the assumption is women will do both and men won't. And I'll just listen to the response. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to turn the conversation a little bit to caregiving, and I know this is something you focus on, Ray. It seems that it's a very important part of the equation to be able to value caregiving, or the value given caregiving. How do we do that better? Because it certainly seems like we may not be doing as good a job as we should be or can be doing.
Well, in certain ways, I think we are doing it well. Men are changing. Millennials want to spend more time with their kids, and they value their caregiving. And we do a lot of work to help men realize that what they're doing is important. On a social level, I'm less clear on how we make those changes. But on the individual level, I think it's actually happening before our eyes as we speak.
I want to turn to Michael, who is calling from Wayland. Michael, what do you have to say about this issue?
Well, I said to your call person, I felt like I turned on a show from 1987 or something. I remember, feeling all this revolution of, you know, we always wanted to do that. But I take umbrage almost to a couple of points. Men shouldn't be celebrated for participating. They should be chastised for not participating. I've gone completely the other way. Like I said, I'm 57. My wife and I work things out so that, you know, if I was able to get kids to soccer, I got them to soccer. If she was, she was. And we worked it out. Her job was as important as mine. The only time money is important is if between the two of you, you're not making enough. I mean, then you have to make those kind of choices. But those, I find, are money choices. It was nice to hear from Lisa, whose husband makes so much, and she's so driven to do her stuff. That's very lucky. They could do anything they wanted to do. But if she was driven and he wasn't making any, and she was doing all the work, then you know, then you'd just call it something different because he's making less money. So I was just maybe formulating a question while I was waiting: is who now is this more for? I'm wondering what men in American society don't know that it's so important for them to participate. What men don't participate? Who's lagging behind in this? Because I really thought this was a revolution of several decades ago.
Ray, you seem eager to answer that.
Among certain groups of people, really the more educated, this is a revolution of several decades. But unfortunately, lower income fathers are not aware of their value as parents. And unfortunately, what's happening in the United States is that more fathers are educated fathers are spending time with their children, but the lower income fathers are more and more absent. There are 23% of children growing up in homes without fathers. So as we see in so many indices, the children are losing out in lower-income families.
I think also it seems to me this is a pretty deeply entrenched issue, as Michael was saying on the phone, and there may be a need to redefine what masculinity is in America before there is sort of some significant changes in this area. And Carol, I wonder what you think about the need to redefine this and create perhaps better role models in popular culture and other areas.
Absolutely, and I think we're... we're in the middle of a transition, or whether it's a sort of like incomplete revolution. Like feminism is sort of still in process. And I think you're right. We do need more sort of social scripts about what it is to be a man, what it is to be a woman, or what it is to be neither, right? What it is to reject these overly narrow conceptions of gender entirely, right? So in some ways, we're seeing a lot more opportunities to really just sort of question what it is to be a human being, right? We're seeing with this with the trans movement and these sorts of things. But there's a question about how much this actually affects the day-to-day lives of a lot of people. And I think pop culture has a huge role to play in giving people ideas to strive for or you know, things to try out. But I think it comes into the way we parent our children, right? So I think this is why Ray's work with fathers is so important, right? Because you know, if you have fathers showing their daughters and their sons how to be involved in caregiving, then that sort of like gives them a new way to sort of approach the world. And I think we're getting there, and we're certainly better than we were a few generations ago. But there's still a long way to go.
Ray, you have something to add?
Yeah, we're seeing it everywhere. There, we refer now to masculinities. There are a lot of different ways to be a man. You see sports stars being interviewed holding their children. You see them being interviewed after games and crying without feeling badly about themselves. There's an integration of feminine quality, traditionally feminine qualities, with masculine qualities. More and more men are emotionally available and emotionally expressive, and I think that's all a good sign. It's part of the trend of masculinities instead of one way to be masculine.
Now, Beth is calling from Framingham. Beth, what's your perspective on this issue?
Well, I just wanted to bring up the topic of mental labor, I guess is what I would call it, the kind of who has the knowledge of what's going on in the family. For instance, my husband and I both work full-time, but I'm still the one that is expected to keep track of doctor's appointments and play dates and school schedules. And I was telling the phone screener that sometimes my kids will be with their dad and I'll be at work or I'll be doing something else, and they will call me from the house to say, where is such and such, or dad doesn't know where this is. And they'll say, oh my gosh, your father's right there with you. But just the fact that women, even if they're participating equally in the paid workforce, are expected to kind of that are going on in the family and maintain those relationships, and that's an extra layer of labor that women oftentimes are responsible for.
Yeah, Beth seems to be addressing some of the social scripts that you were talking about earlier, Carol.
That's absolutely right. I think one thing that maybe listeners can ask themselves is how often they've heard people refer to fathers babysitting their children, right? Fathers don't babysit, they parent. Right, and we would never say that a mother is babysitting her children, right? But we still do that about fathers. And again, so I think that while we've made a lot of progress in at least showing these ideas as a possibility to for our lives. I think it's the, you know, the progress is partial, right? And I think, you know, the idea of the mental labor, the emotional labor being something that goes on, even if there is a sort of formal equality. Again, I think a lot of couples do find that.
I want to take a call from Jeff, who's in the West End. Jeff, what do you have to say?
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of piggyback on Lisa's call from Groton. So my wife and I are both doctors, you know, dual income earners, and my wife makes a lot more money than I do, and she's very aspirational, but I am too. But I'm more of the stay-at-home kind of father involved with the kids' day-to-day, you know, responsibilities, and I find it very, very hard because I feel this magnetic pull, and to the degree that it's, you know, a biological piece combined with a social construct piece, it's very hard to tear myself away from work. My wife says I do a fantastic job with the kids, and I believe her. I really enjoy it. But it's hard as a man to not sort of orient myself towards that, you know, going out and working and aspirational achievement.
Ray or Carol, do you want to respond to Jeff?
I think this is just a common dilemma in dual career couples. There's no easy solution. This is a man who likes being with his kids and also likes working and finds it difficult to leave. I applaud him for expressing the dilemma, which I think is widespread.
Here's something else I think that we can probably add to this discussion, and that's this isn't just a matter of sort of individual social choice. Rather, our choices happen in a larger cultural context. And so one thing that might make it easier for a man who's leaning out, for a man who sees those professional opportunities go whizzing by when he didn't take them because he was, you know, up taking care of a sick kid or these sorts of things, is to sort of realize that, like, okay, you're on the right side of history here, right? If we actually are making feminist progress, then that this is what it's going to look like. And so my thought is that it might actually make it easier to make these professional sacrifices on the individual person if they think, okay, well, this is actually a matter of justice, right?
I want to take one more call. Sophia is in Danvers. Sophia, what are your thoughts on leaning in and leaning out?
Hi. So it's not so much on the child care aspect of all of this or the careers. I'm only 22, but my partner and I have been together for 3 years now, and I say partner even though he's my boyfriend because we and a number of my friends have adopted this method too. We want to take the gender out of being together. It's not boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife. It's two partners who are in it to take care of each other and help each other through the world, and it should be an equal give and take and lean in and lean out when you need it. And so we're kind of on our own doing away with these social structures that kind of impede your life with the other person.
So we've just heard from Hannah, who's 22, which prompts me to ask you, Carol, are you optimistic about reaching a place where men can lean out, and sort of what do you see for the future?
I am optimistic, yeah. I think we are at a point where men are starting to see the value in this. I think we're at a point where women are being taken a lot more seriously in the workplace. And you started off the segment with this discussion of pay equality, right? So I think we are really moving in this direction. Am I optimistic that it's going to happen as quickly as I would like it to? No. And so I think it's actually really great to see, you know, to see young adults in their early 20s really committing themselves to equality, and even something as small and as silly as small as what you call yourselves. It might seem like kind of frivolous or not that big a deal, but I think that these sorts of things really do change the way we think about ourselves, about our relationships, and they're really, really important. My favorite feminist philosopher is a woman named Marilyn Fry, and she has this this great description of what she thinks oppression is like. And she said oppression is like a birdcage, right? So if you're looking at a bird and you're wondering why it's sort of sickly and not really, really flourishing, and if you're only really looking very closely at the bird, you'll never really see what's wrong with the bird. But if you step back a little bit, you might see a wire. And then, if you step back a little bit further, you'll see another wire. And if you take a macroscopic picture, you'll see this bird is completely surrounded by wires. Any one of them by themselves wouldn't really be capable of affecting the bird's life prospects. But all together, because they're systematically interconnected, they completely constrain what's possible for the bird. So she says, this is what oppression is like. And so that's why even when we're talking something about as simple as whether we call ourselves husband and wives or partners, that really can be thought of as one wire in the birdcage.
Now, Ray, I want you to look toward the future and tell me what advice you would give to men. We have about, you know, 20, 25 seconds here.
Yes. Well, I don't like to be prescriptive. The advice I'd give to men is not based in these ideals of justice and equality, which I think are very difficult to define. I think they're defined by couples on their own. I would say for men, it is important to be an involved father. Child outcomes are better when fathers are involved. And also, I think you have to know yourself and decide what kind of a man you want to be in discussions with your partner or your wife.
I think we'll leave it there. Carol Hay is an associate professor of philosophy and director of gender studies at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Thank you, Carol, for joining us.
Thank you.
And Ray Levy is a clinical psychologist and the director of the Fatherhood Project at Massachusetts General Hospital. Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer.
I mean, I would say that a good 70% of the people I know have been playing this game, and anyone who isn't playing it has been asking about it. And I know some people who have no idea what Pokemon is, and they still downloaded it because it's like the big bandwagon right now. So.
So you want to be a master of Pokemon? Do you have the skills to be number
one? I like getting out into Boston and seeing it in a different way. I've lived here for about 8 years, and I've seen parts of the city that I've never really gone to.
I want to go where no one's been, far beyond the crowd.
There are eggs that you can hatch, for example, that require you to walk, you know, 5, 10 or more kilometers in order to hatch the eggs. So it's sort of also like a walking or fitness app, which I rather like.
A few days ago, playing Pokemon Go, I was actually able to meet new people. Like, we'll bump into each other and be like, oh, are you playing Pokemon Go? And they'll be like, yeah.
I have been unable to stop playing Pokemon Go wherever I go around Boston because it's nostalgic and beautiful.
We all live in a Pokemon world.
I played Pokemon Yellow when I was a kid on my Game Boy Color. I mean, I guess I just get to relive part of my childhood.
It is kind of weird going around and seeing everyone with their noses in their phones, but it is a very addictive game, and I am somewhat addicted to it already.
Pokemon.
Those are players Christian Cole, Sarah Marina, Logan Schmidt, Jenny Hong, Reese Donaldson, Ryan Judah, and Robert Elsis. They were speaking with our intern, Catherine Doherty, on Boston Common yesterday about the smartphone game Pokemon Go. And with us here to talk about it is Boston Globe tech columnist Hiawatha Bray. He joins us from the Globe. Welcome, Hiawatha.
Glad to be here.
Hiawatha, why don't you take us through exactly what Pokemon Go is? Give us the basics of playing the game.
Well, basically, you have to know what Pokemon basically involves. It's like you're in this fantasy world, which is inhabited by these little harmless but rather aggressive creatures called pocket monsters, which is what Pokemon is short for. And your goal and the goal of other people in the game is to capture these monsters, train them to fight each other, and then put them in arenas where they have competitive fights. Nobody actually gets killed in any of these fights. They just beat each other up, and if you're the best trainer, your Pokemonsters win the most fights. This has been going on for years. The whole Pokemon phenomenon began in Japan about 20 years ago, and since that time, Pokemon has become one of the world's most popular series of cartoon shows, movies, and video games. About 200 million Pokemon video games had been sold even before this. But this one has taken on a life well beyond anything anyone's ever seen before.
Now, I understand that you've played some Pokemon Go. Is that correct?
That is true.
And what did you think?
It's not my cup of tea, but I can understand why some people would be fascinated by it. This is a really fascinating attempt to combine a bunch of ideas in gaming and come up with something that would be really addictive and entertaining. One of the things that's most interesting about it is that the game is rooted in the real world. This causes cool aspects of it, but it also causes huge challenges because you have to walk to get to various places in order to make things happen in the game. And so, for example, I'm going to tell you right now, I think one of the key reasons this game is as popular as it is, can be summed up in two words. It's July. I guarantee you, when November and December roll around, No, nobody's going to be out there trying to catch them all.
You know, no, we're not Pikachu, searching for Pokemon figures in the snow, in snowbanks.
Absolutely. Pikachu will be fine as soon as it gets cold outside. But for now, it's a great excuse to get outside. And it's amazing, according to a number I just saw, something like, and this is all of America, this game has only been released in the United States, Australia, and New Zealand. It's been downloaded so far in the last week about 65 million times.
Wow.
It's astonishing. What you do is you walk around and randomly on the map that appears on your phone, these monsters appear and you're supposed to collect them. When you try to collect one, you see it on the screen standing on the street where you happen to be. You see the street and the monster appears to be standing on it. And
yeah,
you touch it and you capture it.
I was going to say,
sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say Pokemon Go is an example of what we would call augmented reality, which blends digital technology with the real physical world. And while virtual reality is a completely immersive, entirely digital experience, augmented reality, as I understand it, requires nothing more than a smartphone and not the headset that virtual reality requires. So is Pokemon Go a landmark moment for augmented reality? Are we going to be seeing a lot more of this type of technology on our smartphones?
Great question. Here's the deal. Pokemon Go is an incredibly primitive example of augmented reality, but it is also the first one that really has gotten mass acceptance, and that's extremely important, and it'll become even more important in a couple of months. I'm not sure exactly when, because Lenovo is bringing out a new cell phone called, it has a terrible name, it's called the Fab 2 Pro, and it contains a new technology from Google called Tango. Tango is real augmented reality on a scale you've never seen before. Tango is a phone that scans the room you are in, generates a complete 3D map of the room, and then allows you to put a 3D object on your screen and maneuver it as if it were really in the room. You know Lowe's, the home equipment, the home improvement company?
Yes.
They have already written the Tango app. You can go to Lowe's online, pick out, say, a refrigerator. You will see a digital representation of that refrigerator, and you can take this phone, this Tango phone, hold it up in your kitchen, and move the refrigerator into the spot where you want it to be and see if it fits.
So Pokemon Go is just the start of this, but we're going to be getting actually more practical applications.
Absolutely.
In the future.
Practical applications of augmented reality are about to hit big time because of Tango. Microsoft is working on something called HoloLens. That's a helmet that does that, but their device costs $3,000. The first Tango phone comes out sometime this summer. It's going to cost $500.
Wow.
Now buy this thing.
Let's get back to Pokemon Go and talk about a few sort of, I don't know if you want to call them kinks or hiccups with the game, but there have been some security concerns.
Absolutely.
There have been reports of armed robbers in Missouri setting up shop near lures. And from
That's
a privacy
right.
standpoint, the app requests a lot of access to your phone. So how are the creators of Pokemon Go addressing this?
Well, we got to work at it one step at a time. First, there was the thing about getting access to all your Google information through Gmail. That apparently was a mistake on the part of the people, the company called Niantic that makes the app. They simply screwed up. They have since changed that. And if you sign up for this using your Google account, the access to information has been much more restricted. So they say, we just made a mistake. That's not part of the plan. However, you've got to understand, this app still allows them to follow you around and they know where you are. But hey, newsflash, most of the apps on your phone are doing that already. When you turn on the app, and sometimes even when you don't turn on the app, the people who have that app know where you are. So if that bothers you, you may not want to use a smartphone at all. Mm-hmm. The other thing, though, is the game has this feature called lures. You can buy a feature that will cause a particular place on the map to send out a message to other people nearby saying, come here and get more Pokemons. And it has been used already in Missouri to lure people to locations where they've been robbed. So yes, that's a real threat. All that means is you got to be careful where you play this game. You've got to watch your step. You can't just go to a lure unless it's in a place that's very open, very public, where you know you're going to be safe. So yeah, you have to think about stuff like this. But I don't think there's any reason to be afraid that this is a particularly dangerous game, except if you're walking down the street staring at the screen and you walk into traffic. Then you could get killed.
Yeah, and another issue with the game has been the fact that there are reports of people playing Pokemon Go at Auschwitz, at the U.S. Holocaust Museum, and the Arlington National Cemetery. Those places have discouraged people from playing there. But what is Niantic, the company that produces Pokemon Go, doing about getting those places out of the game, and what can they do, quite frankly,
from a tech
standpoint?
Well, I'm not sure what they're doing. And to be honest, I don't know whether they're doing this, but technically, you know what they could do. It's an idea called geofencing. They can design the game so that it will not work near certain locations. You could do that by simply saying, you know, it's not going to work here because the game uses GPS. It knows where you are. So they could fence off certain areas and say, this game just can't be played here. That is certainly something they could do. I don't know how far they're going to doing it. But yeah, that thing about the Holocaust Museum was pretty appalling. And no, yeah. I don't think they're going to put up with that for very long.
We have just 30 seconds left here, Hiawatha. And I just want to ask you, you mentioned how people won't be playing it in November, but do you see this as Pokemon Go as strictly a fad, or is it something more?
It's not a total fad. I mean, a lot of these people are hardcore Pokemon fans, and they'll keep playing it. The frenzy right now is obviously going to fade away. Frenzies like this always do. But the bigger issue is, I think this is the game that really turns the corner, or starts to turn the corner, and make us take seriously augmented reality. The next big thing is when the Tango phones come out. Then we'll see if this really takes off.
Well, I'm excited to see what lies ahead. Hiawatha Bray is tech columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. We turn now to the Remembrance Project, our series from writer Alyssa Eli about ordinary people who lived extraordinary lives. Today, she remembers a New Hampshire man who wrote poetically about mortality.
Sean Doherty was an Oriental medicine practitioner, an acupuncturist, a triathlete. His diagnosis of stage 4 colon cancer at age 45 interrupted a life of perfect health. After surgery, instead of beginning the traditional but unoptimistic chemotherapy regimen, Sean decided to begin alternative treatments. He was already an expert in them, along with his wife and business partner, Christine Doherty.
He was going to work as hard as possible to get as much quality time as he could. So that's where he did hyperbaric oxygen. You know, we got a far infrared sauna. He was taking 120 supplements a day. He went on the ketogenic diet. Yeah, he really went at it.
At the same time, Sean began writing on Caring Bridge, a personal website for those with illness. He was a born diarist, professorial on topics of epigenetics and biochemistry, bitter about healthcare economics, wrenching about family worries and final travels.
So it was really a big thing for him to be as honest and candid as he was, knowing that other people would be reading it. He also, I think, unflinchingly faced his own mortality and would laugh about it. He was irreverent. That's the other thing about Sean. He was extremely irreverent about everything.
March 14th. I'm left in a place of indifference regarding pretty much all dogma. Religious dogma, scientific dogma, yep, all dogma. I think everything is interconnected because, well, it is. We share atoms with everything. Like Carl Sagan said, we are star stuff. Denser entries were interspersed with bursts of what he called bad haiku.
Try to be, not do. Do or don't do. There is no try. Do, be, do, be, do. And the first time I read that, I was like, my gosh, he just got me to say doobie doobie do. And it actually seemed profound.
March 16th. Live a good life, one of service, with an effort of at least trying to leave things better than how you found them. Oh, wait, one other thing. The idea that death is a failure. Some people feel my choice to not do chemo is the equivalent of giving up. If death is a failure, then so is birth.
Well, so much of the time when he was writing these things and reading them to me, I would think, I've got to enjoy this now because eventually he'll be gone. And he'll be gone soon. It was like I was trying to drink it in with all my senses and memories.
Sean's last Caring Bridge entry was August 27th, 2015. On September 21st, Christine posted on his site. He had died peacefully that morning. She quoted one of his favorite poets, Adam Lindsay Gordon. Life is mostly froth and bubble. Two things stand like stone. Kindness in another's trouble, and courage in your own.
Writer Alyssa Eli remembering Sean Doherty, who died last September in Merrimack, New Hampshire. He was 46 years old. If you'd like to suggest a loved one for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org. And finally today, we're going to end the show with a look at a certain type of food.
I got three kitchens going. I got brisket going at Newman's. I got Kugel working at Mrs. Sanfino's. And this is Kreplach. Here. Try some of this.
No, I don't want to.
Eat, eat. You're skin and bones. Huh?
Oh, this is awful.
Oh, sure. And it's Kreplach. It's an acquired taste, yeah.
Ah, yes, Jewish food. The Jewish deli in particular. Most estimates say they hit their peak back in the 1930s, but now we're seeing a bit of a resurgence. Mamala's Delicatessen opened in Kendall Square this week, and Exodus Bagels and Steinbones are set to open soon. To talk more about Jewish delis in the past and present, we're joined by Corby Kummer, James Beard Award-winning food writer and senior editor at The Atlantic. Welcome, Corby.
Glad to be here.
So you went to Mamala's today in Kendall Square. They just opened Tuesday. What did you eat and how was it?
So I had some of the handmade bagels. I had chocolate babka and I had their home-cured lox and their whipped cream cheese in two varieties because it was 9 in the morning. They open at 8. They do breakfast from 8 to 11 and lunch from 11 to 4. No dinner yet, but that's in the offing. Like, it's a matter of weeks, not months, so they say.
Yeah, the early hour explains why you didn't go for the pastrami sandwich, because I was going to say that's sort of the definition of good Jewish deli food.
Oh, I am so waiting for pastrami, corned beef, and chopped liver, and I saw a big bowl of chopped liver just ready to be spread onto toast or challah.
So you'll be going back?
Oh, often. Yes, frequently.
So I want to know, food-wise, what is it that makes a great Jewish deli? Do you judge a Jewish deli by its pastrami sandwich, by its matzo ball soup, by its chopped liver?
So it's by the meats. That's what most people associate with delis. So what we'll all be looking at is the pastrami, the corned beef. I love tongue. Tongue is among my favorite meats, and I grew up with it. Scarily haunting our kitchen in a pressure cooker, and matzo ball soup. But it's really what people think of and what they go to are overstuffed sandwiches that you can barely get your mouth around. It takes so much to bite into them. And homemade rye bread that has to be quite tangy and have caraway. And they have a very ambitious baking program. So several kinds of babka, several kinds of cookies, and all of their bagels made by hand right there.
I've got to admit, my mouth is watering
at
this point.
As it should be.
Now, like you, I grew up in a family that ate tongue, and it was considered something of a delicacy in our house. But I wonder, is there a limit in terms of how much or how authentic a Jewish deli can be while still appealing to a broader non-Jewish audience? Will it turn off customers to be eating something like tongue? Or, you know, is there a strong appetite for something like schmaltz and gribbenis, which is chicken fat and, I guess, what you would call chicken skin cracklings?
They are cracklings. There shouldn't be. I think, if anything, it's the unfamiliarity and the odd terms that might put people off. But given that people love chicharrones, which are cracklings, and all kinds of pork, all kinds of strange head cheese and charcuterie, tongue is really the mildest of all of this. And tongue just is like better brisket. I mean, it's really sweet. It's so moist. It's so flavorful. There doesn't have to be anything gross about it. It's a very thin slice. So it seems and sounds ethnic because it's out of another era. But given what's so popular in terms of nose-to-tail pork right now, it's as nothing. So it should be mainstream. Schmaltz. Pork fat. Everyone loves lard now. So schmaltz is chicken fat. I said pork fat as a mistake. But in fact, if you go to any of the Eastern European countries and you ask for schmaltz, it's lard.
Oh, interesting.
It's pork fat. It's the generic animal fat term.
Oh, that's interesting. Now, another kind of problem I could anticipate perhaps for Jewish delis from the Jewish audience is you come in and you sort of compare it to your grandmother's cooking, your Oma, your Bubby, and you thinking, well, this kugel isn't quite like my Bubby used to make or quite like my Oma made. I mean, do Jewish delis suffer from that sort of comparison?
Everyone does, and this is going to as well. I was talking with one of the owners. They have they were originally the partners in Hungry Mother in Cambridge, and now they're right at One Kendall Square. Strangely enough, they're right across from Andy Husband's terrific new barbecue smoke shop. So it's like all trafe,
like meat
which
paradise.
Means unkosher. So it's all pork on one side smoke shop. And although they're not actually kosher, Mamala's will be serving no pork. It'll be having, you know, lots of beef and tongue and lots of smoked fish. But also smoked. So it's this resurgence in home-cured meats. So they're doing all of their lox. The lox that I, not all of it. They're getting some from the Cadillac of Brooklyn.
The B. Russ and Daughters?
Well, you see, they say that they're getting from the Brooklyn supplier that supplies Russ and Daughters. And they're getting
intrigue.
It shipped in from Brooklyn several times a week. I had their own home-cured lox, which I found very much like Gravlox. It was very sweet. Very moist and kind of fragrant, terribly fresh. Not what people think of as very salty lox. That will be their Nova lox, which I'm going to taste next time. I have to taste through the entire menu,
of
course.
So you'll be camped out the entire week at Mamala's, from what I'm hearing.
Oh, I think that weeks are going to... 1 week isn't going to be enough.
Now, I want to put this in sort of a broader context. How do you see Mamala's opening in Kendall Square fitting into the larger history of Jewish delis in Boston? There aren't many.
So something that we were talking about, in addition to comparing it to your grandmother's food and never finding it satisfactory because it wasn't actually made by your grandmother. So as the owner was just saying this morning, the matzo ball soup, it's either going to be not salty enough or too salty. The noodle kugel, either it has too much raisins and cinnamons or raisins and cinnamon are absolutely verboten. They never should have been in it. Depending on what your family recipe is. The fact is we don't have a context of delis in Boston. They're making it up. So the owners were very influenced by a book that I excerpted on the Atlantic's website by David Sachs called Save the Deli. And it is an exploration of the delis that remain and the tradition that was going out of style for a long time and is coming back. And so when we go to Mamala's now, we're having their interpretation of a tradition that they're reviving and that Bostonians have not had. It's been a generation-long gap. And so unless you've been to New York, unless you've gone to Russ and Daughters, the Touchstone, Second Avenue Deli, Katz is for pastrami and salami, you won't know these traditions. And so the question is, will you be attracted to them? Will you want to go back after the exoticism of chopped liver and gribbiness? And there's really nothing better than chicken skin cracklings that have been crisped up after the fat has been rendered from the chicken. Then the chicken skin is cut into little half-inch squares and slowly sautéed with onions until it's terribly crisp and crackling. It's often used as a garnish. If you salt it and put it on challah, it's the best snack on earth. So I think everyone likes sweet onions. Sweet onions feature very heavily in Jewish cooking. That kind of long-cooked sweetness. You know, the owner was saying, I sat down a friend of mine who grew up with absolutely no delis, and I said, if you weren't coming out of loyalty to me as a friend, would you ever come to this place again? And he said, I moved to Cambridge. I'd never tasted Indian food in my life. My family goes out for it once a week. It depends on what's there and what you educate yourself with and what you acquire a taste for. So we just have to hope that enough people will acquire a taste for deli food that they'll keep Mamala's alive.
I guess the last question here is, we have about a minute left. Why is Jewish deli important, culturally and food-wise?
It was a way of keeping cultural identity. It was saying, when you go and you have a pastrami sandwich or a corned beef sandwich or matzo ball soup, which everyone can make, chicken soup is common to many cultures, pastrami not so much, and pickles, which are now very fashionable, you're keeping alive a culture and saying, I belong to this identity, mostly Eastern European Jews that came over somewhere between 1890 and 1950, 1960. I want to say I am part of this tradition, as assimilated as I am into the culture. I want to honor my forebears and enjoy this food. And it's a kind of ethnic food that's part of the whole rich melting pot of all the foods we enjoy.
I think I might be headed to Mamalu's soon. Corby Kummer is a James Beard Award-winning food writer and senior editor at The Atlantic. For photos of him eating at Mamalu's this morning, you can go to our website, radioboston.org. Thanks so much for sharing,
Thanks
Corby.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Shira Springer. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.